legal bureau, which was 25, 30 people at that point. And we were sitting there, and I was invited to participate and to sit in. Mm-hmm. And Charette gave a report and did not conceal his anger, and perhaps exaggerating perhaps the prospects of an American change in position. And so he used the word, and I was sitting next to Ben-Gurion, who was sitting on the sideline. And at that point, Charette said, and then came this raid. It was as if Satan had intervened. What Satan? I never forget that. Satan, Satan. And I felt an electric shock in Ben-Gurion. Really, you were sitting like this. He didn't say a word. He didn't reply to him. But that was a rift, in my view. And that was the end of Charette.
But the
political end.
The alienation, if I can call it that, between the Israel and the UN continued further.
Of course.
And going much ahead of the story, I just wanted to ask whether you felt that the eventual resolution on Zionism and racism had a tremendous effect here in Israel, or whether it was more important in terms of the American reaction, the American...
Well, this has a history, isn't it? You see, the Arab position was all through the years, and I don't know whether that has really changed, was this three-point tactic in vis-a-vis Israel, in the international, in their international warfare. Defamation, isolation, elimination. These were the stages. In order to isolate, it has to defame it. And when it is isolated, then you may eliminate it. So they used all, I would say, tricks of the trade they could use. And one of their ideas was to delegitimize Israel. It's the same purpose. By that time, in 1975, the racial issue was, of course, very high on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the greatest defamation you could hurl at anybody was racist racial. Because it was the awakening of Africa, and there was resonance for this. That's one point. So they used this. On the other hand, we were quite involved in a tangle with the Soviet Union on the Soviet Jews. And we used the United Nations Human Rights Commission to draw the attention of the world to the plight of the Jews. And so we certainly didn't like that kind. And they were very rude in their replies, defamatory if you want, until they realized this is a very good idea to give Israel a blow by picking up the racist issue. And when the resolutions were introduced against racism and what else, Nazism, anti-Semitism, didn't appear, but something of that, but Zionism, yes, and racism, Israel racist. So they took this up as a kind of a counterblow to silence us, serving by this the Arab objective of isolation, defamation, isolation, elimination. So I don't think that the Soviets were in support of the Arab, in Zionism there was always the word Endziel, the final target, final objective. Elimination was not in the Soviet book.
No.
So, but they went along, I think, in their tactical struggle with Arabs, first of all, in order to support the Arabs, and secondly, to shake us off from there, get us out of there, of their hair, with all these protestations of us against Soviet treatment of Jews. So that's, I think, the reason for it. Mm. And if you remember that the time for... Soviets always used the Hitlerite argument, the Nazi argument, they would blame the Nazi, then if you are pursuing Nazi policies, you are scum of the earth, I mean, and nothing has to, there's no reason to protect you, not the charter will protect you, or not your friends have to protect you. So they pushed us, together with the Arabs, into this category, and basically, it were not the Arabs who formulated this 75, how would I say, amendment or addition.
Yes. Right?
It was Soviets put in the word race, racist. And I discussed this thing much later in the Soviet Union, 2 years ago, and they admitted that my analysis was right.
Really?
Yes, oh yes. That they were just furious at us, that we, this little state, like a hornet, like a wasp,
yes,
was all the time doing trouble for them internationally. These bloody Jews and so on.
Yeah. You know?
And so they hit back, as brutal they can be. Mm. They had a companion. And that was the, in my view, that was the background of the 1975 revolution.
Interesting, because it has had, of course, enormous repercussions.
It
has had enormous repercussions.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Because we understood this is part of the delegitimization of Israel. So Israel becomes an outcast. And our positions in Africa, which we had steadily built up, were affected by it. And who cares for a country which is racist? And I mean, you might remember in 1967, I was permanent representative. I had these discussions with Fedorenko when he attacked us. And he called us Nazis. I mean, the Nazis, we are acting like Nazis. And I knew what he was up to. And I had to very strongly reject him by reminding him that they were the first who entered into an alliance with the Soviets and cared a damn about the defense of the West, of civilized humanity. Oh, yeah, we had these discussions, which were quite...
If you would have had to draw a balance now as to the utility of the United Nations to Israel and the hardships, difficulties that the United Nations has caused, where would you draw the line? Do you think that the relationship has been... I mean, obviously Israel exists in part because of the United Nations.
Well, I would say that Israel, without the United Nations, would have had great difficulty to establish itself in the world against a hostile environment. With the United Nations, in the United Nations, we had to pay the price for that glory again of being in. But basically nobody would have ever thought here unless crackpots on the right would say, my God, we boycott this organization, we leave this organization. No, we knew we had to be there, we had to swallow, we had to defend our position there. And the United Nations always, I mean, after all, was an important wind tunnel of political warfare and of propaganda, so we had to stand up. No, I think balance is quite clear. And if you see now that the United Nations is changing, has been changing, But some people may say that's to the worst for Israel again, because they will now all gang up against Israel. And others will say, well, they may be a positive force.
What do you think? Because that's what's going to be one of my questions. There is a basic change in the United Nations because of the basic change in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Soviet Union, which for most of the history was hostile to Israel, now is friendly, at least with the United States, and its relations with Israel have improved.
Mm.
Do you think this is going to make the United Nations a more effective instrument, a more supportive instrument for Israel, and bring about greater possibilities of settlement?
Well, I wrote an article a few months ago, which spoke more or less, I think the heading was, "The Ring is Closing." Mm-hmm. And I said 43 years ago, the United States and Soviet Union worked together to redress the injustice of the Jewish people and to return its independence. But they were not able to work for a peaceful adjustment between the Arabs and Israel, because the Cold War was blowing on between Soviet Union and the United States, and the hot winds were of hostilities were blowing here in Israel-Arab relations. Now, I said, after 43 years, the ring is closing. The Soviet Union and the United States are now, my view, going to work together to bring about a peaceful settlement of this conflict. And I don't speak in this article about whether it is exactly will be satisfactory. It will not be said any satisfactory. It cannot be satisfactory to any of the parties. It must be a compromise. But I say here we see this development at the end of the Cold War. The Cold War prevented, and the Cold War and the hot hostility of the Arabs prevented a settlement. But they started on the right track satisfying a need of Israel for its independence. And therefore I believe now that they would now we reach a point now very clear that Soviet Union and the Soviet and the United States will under their auspices to try to promote a settlement. A complete different question whether they can make it. But we had the first indication of that attempt in 1973, the Geneva Conference. Well, it was handled in a different way because the Cold War was still on.
Yeah.
And Kissinger used the conference to proceed with his own diplomacy, which then culminated, as a matter of fact, in the peace agreement with Egypt. This time, I think the cooperation between the Soviet Union and the United States will be more adjusted between them. It will not be a situation where one side will just support one side and the other side, or the United States or the Soviet will try to run away with the problem and to settle it in their own way. No, I think they will try to coordinate positions, if and all events. So in this regard, the United Nations will be involved. I mean, here they won't like it, but it will be involved. And for the following reason. I mean, I would be glad if the Holy Spirit would come over all these about the conflicting parties, and say, now let's sit together and make peace and so on, or some kind of a Sadat would appear and say, no, I want to have that thing settled. Well, it would be beautiful if this would work, or Assad would appear in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
that you'll find. It wouldn't happen this way. And it can't happen because the load is so heavy for both sides to lift it. They're just not capable to lift that conflict. And they don't have enough flexibility in their political processes. I wrote about it a few days ago in the Herald Tribune piece. They just don't have it, and therefore, that in all Israel-Arab diplomatic encounters which were successful, a third party assistance was needed. Whether it was in Rose, or it was the beginning in 1947 at the General Assembly, or whether it was in Camp David, it just doesn't go at all. I mean, I'm sorry, but these are the mechanics of the problem. Now, certainly we would be happy if the third party would be some kind of a Camp David, but again, it doesn't work anymore like this. And the United States is committed to cooperate with the Soviet Union for understandable reasons in this way. And the Europeans wouldn't stand aside. I mean, it's all nonsense that the Europeans, that one can handle, make a security conference and the Europeans will just applaud. It wouldn't be this way. And even in order to get the Security Conference, or whatever they call it, the regional conference,
yes.
Why, they need a convener. I mean, we have seen this in 1973.
Yes.
And I was in that time involved in these Kissinger maneuvering. Okay. So you need a convener. Who will be the convener? The convener will be the United Nations Secretary General. And Israel will try to make everything possible that his role should be limited as in 1973.
Yeah.
But I wonder why Mr. Baker hasn't introduced it. He may have it, obviously. We accepted Resolution 338, and we all the time speak about 242 and 338, fine. But 338 has a companion resolution, which authorizes the Secretary to organize the negotiations and to report back from time to time to Zucker about this point, so that the Security Council could consult the parties and so on. It's there. So if we have accepted 338, 344 belongs to it.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So it will come anyways. It will come anyways. Unless the whole thing blows up. But I believe that Mr. Baker must be aware that it can't be handled just on a very limited thing.
Well, as a matter of fact, it brought me, though, to a subject that I wanted to ask you about, and that is precisely Resolution 242. Because I think that you were quite involved in the various negotiations that went into that, and I wonder if you would just describe how that developed from your perspective in 1967.
Well, I think I gave a very detailed account in my book about this on 33 decades of Israeli foreign policy. And it started, I mean, the discussion of 242, as a matter of fact, was started on the first day of the war in 1967. And by two opposing positions, the United States took a position of ceasefire, but not return to the lines, as they had done in 1956, the lines of fighting. And of course our line was exactly to contend ourselves with ceasefire at the appropriate time, which was when the military had accomplished its mission. So, when the Security Council discussions ended, the ceasefire, which was then in place on the 11th of June, the whole problem of the future disposition, what should be gun was the situation, was open. And then you remember that the United Soviet Union asked for the convening of a special session, emergency session. And they sent their first team with Prime Minister Kosygin and his assistants. On that day, the day before opening conference, President Johnson made a statement of policy of 5 or 6 points, which to my, in my view have remained the policy of the United States until today. Some additions, but not much change. But then all return to the armistice regime, etc. You know,
right.
Freedom of navigation, peace should be, so should be the objective. Now, the Soviets, and the Arabs of course, were trying to avoid the consequences, the political consequences of change. And therefore, they tried to use very vague and non-committal formulations in the discussions. The Arabs insisted on the evacuation of the territories, or the territories, and compensation for war damages, and what else. And so resolutions or draft resolutions were tossed around from one side to the other. And who was not all this? This was the great marketplace for the busybodies, for the diplomatic busybodies. But basically, United States and Soviet Union tried to work it out. Arthur Goldberg and not Fedorenko, he had already lost his usefulness, but Kuznetsov who came, and Dobrynin was put in, and Gromyko in the end. And after some weeks of wrangling, I mean, they worked out, from our point of view, a very unsatisfactory resolution of the end of the state of war or something of this for, not for complete withdrawal, but a formula which certainly did not advance us towards peaceful settlement, real peaceful settlement. And we had, it was the only time when I really had some trouble with Arthur Goldberg about it. And he was quite annoyed that we were not very happy with his work of art, which he had worked out with Gromyko. And he explained to me in quite stern terms, you see, you don't think I know how to negotiate. I was a labor negotiator all of my life. And basically what you said to me, you don't come and teach me how to negotiate. So I said, Arthur, I will tell you what the difference is. It's a labor negotiator and the diplomatic negotiator with the Soviet Union. Of course, I recognize your enormous achievements in labor. When you negotiate, the unions negotiate with Ford in Detroit, you have a common objective to manufacture a car. The better conditions, best conditions. When you negotiate with the Soviet Union, you want to manufacture a car and they want to manufacture a road accident. And I will not be a partner to that road accident. Well, he laughed as you did. And that restored the friendship. That was it at the time. I mean, the man who really answered Kuznetsov in the same way and transferred that problem from Washington to Arthur Goldberg back was Dean Rusk.
Yeah.
And he said to Kuznetsov, what you want me to do is to swap a rabbit for a horse, and we are not in that trade. Arthur Goldberg, in a different way, didn't see the rabbit and the horse then. Anyhow, they had worked out the formula, and thanks to our great collaborators, the Syrian delegation, they rejected the draft resolution. And therefore the special assembly, emergency assembly, dispersed without resolution. So there was some vacuum, and towards the resumption of the diplomatic season in September, they started to work out on something has to be done. And then you know, the Indians were first who tried to do work out something. The United States believed that they had an agreement with King Hussein. King Hussein had come to New York by saying that he had met on the 17th of September Nasser and had reached an agreement on an acceptable resolution, etc., etc., etc. That was one of these wishful thinkings of King Hussein. The British then went into it. Americans wanted to be the main sponsor. Our position in New York, in Jerusalem, was too hesitant to encourage Arthur Goldberg to go ahead. He was right at that time, and Washington was right that they should keep things under control. So Carradine worked on this, and of course he was more inclined to be compromising, but of course he also was in close touch with the Soviet, with the United States, and with us too.
And that's what I was going to ask. He was in touch with you.
Oh yes, oh yes. And he realized that certain things just wouldn't work. And he tried then to compromise, and with great skill, I mean, he put the most contradictory things into one resolution. The inadmissibility of acquisition of territory, the inadmissibility of the use of force. So if you hadn't, if the Arabs wouldn't have used the force for 40 years, for at that time was less than 40 years, would have used for it, there would not have question been of acquisition of territory. I mean, he put it this way. And and he had to put the inadmissibility in because the Latin Americans insisted on this very strange, vague principle, because it's not a charter principle at all. The charter principle is the inadmissibility of war, and the admissibility of self-defense. So this became an androgynous, I mean, in a certain way. Kissinger loved it because what he called it constructive ambiguity.
Yes.
And Johnson was very firm to get the thing through. There was one, they had just, you know, the correspondence between Johnson and Kissinger until the last minute on the territories, which were from the territories, from all the territories.
Yeah.
And Johnson was very firm on that, and take it or leave it, and so on, and Soviets came along. There was one interesting thing in it. The Soviets had introduced, the resolution was adopted on the 22nd of November, on the 20th. The Soviets introduced their own draft, which was much milder than any of the drafts which they had before. It included a paragraph on the arms race in the Middle East, stop the arms race in the Middle East. The American draft also included paragraph, nearly similar language, that they should get together and the arms dealers, the arms suppliers and so on should be supervised or something, or the arms race should be come under control. And despite of the Soviet Union and the United States agreeing on the same paragraph, it was eliminated in the British draft, this particular paragraph. Was eliminated, as I understood, upon the Arab insistence, because they had to replenish, as they believed, their arsenals after the defeat in 1967. Therefore, they couldn't, was not in their interest to have a limitation on armaments. So that was 2-for-2. I think one of the most durable resolutions and diplomatic workhorses ever invented.
Now, I wanted to ask you again a rather broad question in this respect. 2-for-2 is, in a sense, an expression of territory for peace, exchange of territory for peace.
I don't say so.
You don't say so?
No. I wrote about that this Saturday in the Heraldry.
Really? I haven't read that. Let me ask the question, though, and let me then hear the reason why you don't think so. Because I was going to trace it back a little bit and ask you a related question. In 1956, Ben-Gurion, after the war was over, wrote a letter to President Eisenhower
mm-hmm.
that you're familiar with. I know, maybe you wrote it.
No, I wasn't.